Hi, Ocean. It's a pleasure to be here at the Max Planck Institute. I spent quite a lot of time here, and it's always a real pleasure to be back. The topic will be different from most of the topics I've been hearing at this conference. And since it's the end of the day and you'll all be tired, let me make you think a little bit. Probably you'll find an answer straight away. So the main issue in this talk is evaluating functions at poles. So let us look at this function, z1 minus z2 over z1 plus z2. And my question to you is, what is its value at zero? At z1 equals zero, z2 equals zero. There are many possibilities, as we all know, but the talk will end given one possibility among the ones I name here, namely zero, using a locality principle. And I want to show you that this locality principle has something to do with the one most of you might have heard of, the quantum physics. Before I go on, as you could see on the first page, this is based on joint work with people. Pierre Clavier, who's here, and if you went to his talk, you might recognize some of the concepts that he mentioned around the notion of tree. And then two other collaborators, Lee, who's at Rutgers, and Bing, who's at Sichuan University in Chengdu. Okay, please hesitate to ask questions as I go along. This is supposed to be understandable, so if you don't understand or ask, please stop me at any time. The poles will be here. So you see here, z1, z2 in the denominator is linear in z1 and z2, and that will be very important. What's red is supposed to be polar. What's in blue is supposed to be holomorphic. What's in blue is what we want to keep. What's in red is what we want to get rid of. Let's see how we can map that. So first of all, let me give you a setup and some aims. We'll change as we go along, because we'll refine our questions as we go along. So our first is to renormalize certain zeta functions at poles. So what are we, objects are we going to look at? We're going to generalize multiple zeta functions. So before I start talking about generalizations, let me just give you an idea of what they'll look like. Some will be associated with trees, and they will be in green. Some will be associated with cones, and they will be in brown. Why cones, why trees? It's a bit arbitrary, yet they have something in common that they present a hierarchy of divergences, subdivergences. I could divide it to this list of higher structures, Feynman graphs, but this will not be the topic of this talk, but similar techniques could be applied to Feynman graphs. So I'll try to show you why these two types of zeta functions generalize multiple zeta functions. So I'll revisit multiple zeta functions and zeta functions in two ways. First, introducing the notion of symbol, two-dimensional symbol, here very simple. It'll just be powers of x in one variable. Whoever here is familiar with pseudo-differential analysis, you must think x is x in pseudo-differential analysis, the cotangent variable of the physics is momentum k. So k to the power minus s, Xi to the power minus s. This s is the one which is sometimes called z. In the zeta, in the Riemann function, which probably you know, summing n to the power of ss from 1 to infinity. And then you see I've rewritten it as a sum of sigma s n. This looks kind of useless at this stage, which it is, but it's useful later on. I won't insist much on that, but then you can consider higher zeta functions, multiple zeta functions, they're nested zeta functions, so the difference is in this hierarchy here that you're introducing in the arguments, 1nk. And you guess 1sk in the powers, so you can rewrite this as a product of sigma s1n1, sigma sknk, the summation being on under this addition that the ni's are in that order. You could consider instead zeta star, which I won't dwell on this talk. I'll just want to mention as we go along, where I've replaced smaller than by smaller or equal to. Later on, this could be for the first one to open cones, for the second one to close cones, but this won't be too important here. So now I'm revisiting again multiple zeta functions, but seeing them as particular tree-like sums or conical-like sums. So let me make that precise. So let us consider lap trees. My trees will be lying down. Not very good at doing pictures on the computer. So they, instead of having standing up trees, my trees will be lying down. So this is a single root tree. So root, they're all rooted trees, so they have a root, and you have branches coming out of the root, maybe a trunk, and then branches, or maybe direct branches. And so this is just one root. You decorate this root with these symbols. So now you begin to understand that these symbols might play a role, and you assign to this root symbol zeta of s. Then, as I said, this is a lying down tree. So to this tree with k vertices, you're going to assign zeta function. I just as well have assigned the zeta star. This is a matter of choice. People assign an open, a zeta function with the strict inequalities. Now, let me, a little bit of analysis again, go to another picture. This is the zeta regularization point of view we've adopted here. We could take a Laplace type regularization, heat kernel type regularization, and this is using the inverse Mellin transform. What does the Mellin transform do for you? It transforms a function which has a nice behavior at infinity, and at zero it has a polyhomogeneous behavior into a new function. And so, for example, you see the exponential, decreasing exponential, which is a typical Schwarz function, and which is nicely behaved at zero, will transform into what we started from, the x to the minus s. So go the other way, I'm not going to give all the technical details in about what conditions you can go the other way. So taking the inverse Mellin transform, you can go for multi-zeta functions to sums in involving Laplace transforms on cones. So you see to zeta s instead of zeta s, now I'm looking at it as a sum from n going to infinity that hasn't changed. I've put here instead e to the power minus epsilon n, which is in the inverse of this Mellin transform of to the power minus s. And this is just to relate it to known work, known approaches in the literature, surprisingly in equivariant geometry. So we'll see that we rely partly on work by Berlin and Verne. This you can see as the discrete Laplace transform of the one-dimensional tone, which is just R plus. Okay, so, and called chain cone, you'll see why, because if I do this for multiple Z function with K entry, K arguments, and do the same thing, but I iterate the inverse Laplace transform, we find ourselves on a chain cone now, really, so chain because of this hierarchical structure among the Xi's, X1 is larger than X2, etc., smaller than K. So here again, you have a discrete Laplace transform on a cone, and you see we're summing on the lattice points of this cone. Okay. So this is, these are ways of viewing the multiple beta functions we had before, one associating it to a tree, the other one associating it to a cone. And from there, we build two pictures, one using, one building conical zeta functions, the other one building what we'll call notched zeta functions. So we're going to renormalize them at poles, just as the zeta function a priori verges beyond the known domain, obvious domain of convergence, real part of S larger than one. You can expect that these higher zeta functions might also diverge beyond a certain domain of convergence and present some poles. So we want to renormalize them at those poles. First of all, what do we do? To a tree, we assign a branch zeta function, and it's, I'm not going into the details, but you can check that there is a domain of convergence as we expect, and the same for cones, and I'll tell you more later on how they're defined. And now we want to study them beyond the domain of convergence, both of them, and for that, we'll have to be a bit more precise, say what they look like if we want to study them at poles, and we're going to discuss the fact that they extend to multivariate meromorphic functions with linear poles. Multivariate, because we started with, we decorate each vertex of the tree, or each edge of the cone with a symbol, and each of these symbols carried a variable, S1, Sk, so we expect multivariate meromorphic functions. What is not obvious is that the poles will be linear, and this is a very interesting feature, which also comes up when you look at Feynman integrals. And then once we understand these poles, we want to renormalize these functions at the poles, and for that, we'll extract a reasonable finite part. What that means is to come, yet to come. Questions for the moment? Okay, so what's the analogy with quantum field theory? This will be very superficial. This analogy could be made precise. To an observable, we assign a mean value over a space of configurations or using an ill-defined measure. And here we're going to assign to a tree a value which will be this higher zeta function defined by the tree, decorated tree by symbols. P is supposed to be a pole. At some point, we'll just focus on zero. We'll translate all the poles to zero. The same thing for a cone. So you have to imagine the tree can be infinitely big and like real trees. And the cone, it's by definition of a cone. If you put a lattice on the cone, there are bound to be infinite many points on this lattice in the cone. So you expect these functions, these sums, exponential sums, to present poles. Okay. Trees versus cones. And then, of course, we might discuss why they're interesting. Let's compare them. Both carry filtered structures, filtered by the dimension of the cone, You can imagine a two-dimensional cone or a k-dimensional cone as we had before, and the size of the tree, how high the tree is and how many branches it has, so how many vertices it has. And this this filtration, which can lead to a grading, applies to a hierarchy in the type of divergences, and that's exactly what's difficult to deal with. But that's what makes it interesting. You don't only have divergences, but you have sub-divergences. They're all mixed up, and our job is to understand how to disentangle this mess. Discrepancies. Trees are more rigid than cones. Cones seem to be quite a universal object to study poles. Trees are much more rigid, but used because they're easier to handle, I think. So why are they easier? And that you heard in Pierre Clavier's, that they're governed by a grafting operator. The grafting operator, what it takes two trees, so two trees, and it joins them up with a root at the bottom. And it builds a bigger tree. You can also just put trees next to each other and then you concatenate these trees. Now, this grafting operator is very rigid, and this is what makes it relatively easy to go about with trees. What do we do? So remember I told you we introduce symbols. You might have thought, why introduce symbols? It's exactly for this reason. We can now define a map which to a symbol assigns the symbol from one to an open variable. This is like a discrete integration map. Do it like that. Okay, so this is a Rota-Baxter operator. Rota-Baxter just means you have discrete integration by parts. And using this grafting operator, this rigidity, you can lift it from root to the whole tree. So it kind of propagates through the tree using universal properties of the tree, which I'm not going, oops, that wasn't too, this way, which I'm not going to comment now, but that's what's at the back of this construction. Cones, then rigid, chain cones would be, and you can assign to trees chain cones, but there's much more freedom cones than there is among trees. And they're still by subdivisions, which is something one can understand. And this is very much related to Stoeffel regions for those of you who are familiar with that. So using this these subdivisions, you can do things on smooth cones, the ones that are spanned by a basis, a particular basis, and then generalize to any convex cones. I should say they're strongly convex, they're point cones at zero, and this you can do using linearity and subdivision. Okay, so now locality, which is in the title. So this is a little more ambitious. We want to normalize, so to define these a priori infinite sums at poles while preserving locality, which will come down to multiplicativity, as you'll see. So we want to normalize while preserving locality. And what do I mean by locality? So locality will translate in terms of multiplicativity, and let's go back to these observables that we were measuring. We don't really understand this bucket, which looks harmless, but which is a black box. This is a mean value over a space of configuration using ill-defined volume measure, infinite dimensional manifolds. But what we know is that if the original two events were independent, then the measurement should factorize somehow. And this is very much related to what we all learn at school or maybe university that integrating a product of two functions in with separable variables comes down to factorizing the two and integrating separately each of these functions. This is exactly what we're saying, because they're complicated integrals, but they're integrals too. So that's the idea. Okay, so we want to do that for some trees. So I'm not yet telling you what is independent trees. We'll have to make sense of that. But what we know is if we concatenate two trees, this makes, I've only spoken about trees, but of course, we will assign zeta functions to forests, which are concatenations of trees. So let's take two concatenated trees, which build a forest, build a zeta function, and what we want is that the zeta function at the pole, this little forest, arises out to product of two zeta functions. These same thing for cones. Now we're taking the Minkowski sum of these of two cones and want the same thing. So what I'm not telling you is what independent means, and this is what we're going to try to make precise. So we're going to interpret that in terms of a locality on the top, a locality relation on the algebra of trees and the algebra of cones. So maybe you can't see that, this little RN, but this is the important message. We go from a phi, I'll define now, this is the measurement, to renormalize phi. And this is a squiggly arrow, which is to say that it's quite dangerous, it happens in the middle, so let's see. So what's the data? We've got an algebra, think of three cones. Concatenation is the product and Minkowski's sum, concatenation of trees to build forests, and Minkowski sum of cones. They are both commutative. They wouldn't have to be, but for us, this is commutative. So this is the product on this algebra, and what do we want to do? We want to assign to a tree a branched zeta function, or to a cone an exponential sum, and we know we have to expect, oh, something happened. We have to expect some meromorphic functions, so that's our task, to define what meromorphic functions could be. And the phi is this black box, which assigns to a tree a meromorphic function, to a cone a meromorphic function. They're not that black, not dark, these boxes, as they would be Feynman graphs, since trees and cones are relatively simple. And we want a factorization. So remember, these intervals of product functions should factorize. The same thing for phi. Phi is now a discrete interval. It's a discrete sum. So higher zeta functions, we want this kind of property. This is not yet really the locality principle, because here there's no information about A1 and A2 being independent. And that's what we want to put into the picture. So, but before we do that, if we stop at this stage, we don't know what to do with these meromorphic functions, and we need to spit out a number. And this is what REN for renormalization should do. Somehow, from this phi, we want to build a number. So from these meromorphic functions, and unfortunately, we really need to evaluate them at poles, because let's say really we live at a pole. The dimension of our space-time being an integer makes us have to confront poles constantly. And so we'll have this task of making sense of REN to go from a meromorphic function to its value at a pole, and yet still fulfilling this requirement, so you see, this was a bit vague. We only want this to hold for the renormalized values when A1 and A2 are independent. It would be too much to ask that it always holds, and that's not what we want. Locality is just saying if they're independent, they should be measured in an independent way. So that's what we should keep in mind. Yes, later. Yes, sorry. Is phi compatible with the graph of the trees? Yes, because that's how it's built. I won't say it here, but the universal property takes care of its compatibility with the graph. But I won't comment on this. I don't think I have time. But we can talk about that later. Yes?
Tell us what independent means.
No, not yet. I'm going to tell you. Sorry, I haven't told. The question is whether I had said what independent means, and I'm soon going to say what it is. So back to higher zeta higher zeta functions. What would be the algebra? They would be pointed convex cones equipped with a Minkowski sum, rooted forests. So the other possibility is rooted forests equipped with concatenation product. And now I told you a priori they could pose in many places, in fact, a countable number of folds, but we'll all push them back to zero. So we'll be talking about germs of magnetic functions at zero. What is the map in our case? Exponential sums on cones. I mentioned them at the beginning, these Laplace transforms, and branch z functions, so these higher z functions obtained using universal properties by decorating the tree at each vertex and branching through the tree, this summation we knew how to do on one vertex. Let me talk about the analytic setup first, before going to locality, which will be more algebraic, tell you what kind of functions, what is M? Said we would land in meromorphic functions, and then there will be here a notion of independence. So a first approach is to take one variable, and that's how I think physicists would, when they think of dimensional regularization. We all live in the same dimension, whether we want it or not, so we're all regularized in the same way, because physicists regularize, in inverted commas, the dimension, replacing the dimension by a slightly perturbed dimension to avoid it being an integer. So if we do this, then there's only one variable, and I told you the red would be the bad part, and the blue the good part, and what one would like to do is to extract from a meromorphic, from a Lorentz expansion, the blue homomorphic germ at zero, and then evaluate it. The holomorphic part of the Taylor expansion at zero, or Lorentz expansion at zero, and evaluate it at zero. So this is called minimal subtraction scheme. What do you do? You take out this red part, the polar part, just keep the holomorphic part and evaluate it at zero. Okay. Now, this has drawbacks because it doesn't satisfy what we want, this factorization property. If you evaluate this way a product, you most often will not end up with a product of evaluations. Six, for example, and that is a very useful example to keep in mind, and you can keep thinking of the first example I gave you right at the beginning of the talk, which is somewhat similar. Z over Z, very simple example, but Z over Z is one, and if you evaluate first at zero and then one over Z is zero, you'll have zero. So there's a problem. This has to do with counter terms. Z over Z are a kind of fake finite parts which you want to keep, and physicists develop very sophisticated devices like the Forrest formula, which Cohen and Kreimer interpreted as the Birkhoff factorization method to get rid of them. So you see those unwanted finite parts rise, and you compensate them by an algebraic device, for example, Birkhoff factorization. So you see, it comes from the fact that starting from an algebra, the meromorphic germs are zero. You have a subalgebra, holomorphic ones, that's no problem. But then the counter terms, they don't form an ideal. You see, that's exactly what you see here. You quickly step out of these quotients and step back into the holomorphic. Those are the fake finite terms. So the fact that it's not ideal is responsible for counter terms, which you, for fake finite parts. You recognize our first example? So what are we going to do? We're not going to regularize everybody along the same lines. We're going to regularize each symbol at each vertex of the tree differently with its own variables, so each one with its own regularization. Same thing for cones. And so this way we'll have several variables. For example, instead of Z over Z, we'll have Z1 over Z2. So that you never forget that Z1 is not Z2. They live in two different worlds. The same for this starting example I gave you. And so we shouldn't forget that they're different. First, we're going to introduce an independence. You can call it locality, orthogonality. So think of this being carried by E1 is a canonical basis of R infinity, orthonormal basis. So this would be carried by E1, this by E2, and orthogonal for the canonical inner product. You can keep in mind that there's a choice here. Choosing an inner product, we could choose another. Same thing for the start example we had at the beginning. This is E1 plus E2 is orthogonal to E1 minus E2 for this inner product. So, and then we're only going to allow ourselves to multiply the germs. So those which involve orthogonal variables. Okay, so this we allowed to be multiplied by that, but we don't allow ourselves to multiply Z1 by 1 over Z1. Okay. Okay, so this leads us to meromorphic with linear poles. What are they? Holomorphic germs in the numerator, and below the powers of linear form. That looks very special, but in fact, it seems to be general enough to encode all the examples, at least I know of, including Feynman integral, although there's, I don't know of any proof. They all lead to this type of function, but say, I think it belongs to folk knowledge due to the gamma function, in fact. Okay, so you see these are linear forms, all of them, the top ones and the big bottom ones, and we never forget what this function depends on, because we can only multiply it a function which depends on other things. So that's why we define a dependence vector space spanned by linear forms involved in this function. This can be made precise. Okay. Any question? Okay, so now let's see. Remember that we had this univariate null subtraction scheme by which we threw away the red poles and the blue holomorphic germ. We want to do the same thing in this multivariate context. For that, we have to use a composition, and you can indeed decompose. And in fact, this was simultaneous work with the same work by Michel Verne and Nicole Berlin. For other reasons, they did that. And so M minus, you guess maybe it's versions of the form I showed you before, but the top linear forms have to be completely independent of the bottom one, so they have to be orthogonal. These are non-simplifiable fractions, you could think of them like that, or quotients. Okay, so that's what's said here. The dependence of vector space of H of the numerator is orthogonal to that of the denominator. And then we'll say, so this orthogonality means that the variables involved in the F1 have nothing to do with those in the F2, meaning that the dependent sets found by the linear forms in the first one is orthogonal to the dependent set spanned by the linear forms involved in the second one. I told you that a problem for one level was that the post parts didn't form an ideal, that there was these fake finite parts. But we'll see that we have a locality ideal. What does that mean? So I'll give you the definition later on. You can keep this in mind. FCK will be a locality algebra. So this means something precise, but let me just, you have to think of MC of K together with this orthogonality relation. And we'll define a category which encodes the ordinary category of algebra, or also a set of locality algebras, locality sets, and both the set theorem of CK, M plus of CK, are locality algebras. And now the advantage is that M minus of CK was not an ideal and is still not an ideal, is a locality ideal. I'll tell you later what that means. So we've seen something in that we introduce this locality. There will be no fake counterterms, the message here. So what our main protagonists will be working with all along? We have this orthogonal splitting. We're going to project onto M plus. This is what we did in one variable setup. What we did minimal subtraction. We first got rid of the poles, the red part, projecting onto the holomorphic part. Going to do that, and this will be a locality morphism. This is related to this locality ideal property. And then once we're on safe ground, here we're on safe ground. This is holomorphic. We can evaluate at zero, no problem. Okay. So algebraic locality structures. Let's now come to the maybe more interesting part for this audience. So the locality category, or category of locality set is just a set together with a symmetric binary relation. We could even drop symmetric, which is very kind of disappointing. There's not much to it, but it's very helpful. So this T, you can think of orthogonality for the moment, helps. It's just a subset of the Cartesian product of your set with itself. So it's symmetric, and we'll call it locality or independence. And this this couple XT, we'll call a locality set. And then we'll use a notation very similar to perpendicular relation. X1 is independent of X2 if the couple lives in this subset of the Cartesian product. Two basic examples. One obvious one, you might already have thought of, disjoint sets, and it's useful. For example, that's someone asked about locality or independence on trees. That's exactly what we're going to use on trees. Two trees are independent if their decorating sets are disjoint. Remember, the decorations were symbols, and they involved Z, S or ZIs, parameters. Parameters should be disjoint, should have nothing to do with each other. Another one which is very important, we already said, is orthogonality, and this take place on a Euclidean vector space. Okay, so we've already used this one, remember? So in fact, we have, without saying it, already equipped homomorphic functions in several variables with a locality relation, because we've already seen when two functions were independent, when their dependent sets were orthogonal. These were the vector spaces, the linear forms on which they depend. Once you have these sets, do something with them, and you can do partial operations. So take a locality set with its graph, so the subset of X2 of independent couple, and then we're only going to allow ourselves to multiply those that are independent. That was a hope. Shouldn't forget that. So partial operation, okay? So think of independence in quantum field theory. We're only going to alternate observables that have to do with each other, that live in or independent parts of space. Partial product on meromorphic germs, we've already talked about. So remember that we had two of these. We only allow ourselves to multiply them when the linear forms involved upstairs here and downstairs here have nothing to do with those there. So nothing to do meant orthogonal. Okay. The dependence sets were orthogonal. So what do we do with that? We can try to build locality semigroups. I'm going to make that short. But you can imagine you only allow yourself to multiply independent elements, and then when you have three and you work about associativity, you have to make sure that once you've multiplied two and both of them were independent of the third one, that the product is independent of the third. That's what's said here in more sophisticated terms. And then once you're allowed to do the product, it will be associative in the usual sense. It's about allowing ourselves to multiply objects. Locality vector space is harmless. This is not the real problem. The problem was the product summing or linear combinations. You just have to make sure that your linearity is compatible with this locality relation. So you can think of an orthogonal, the orthogonal. So the points that are all independent of a set should be the linear space. Okay. Then you put all this together, and you have a locality algebra. If you put all this together again, the real focus is on the product. Okay. You can think of this little camp example to see that it's not, there are things that, despite this rather very flexible definition of locality, things can go wrong. For example, if you want to introduce the locality relation on a subset on R, and say that two elements are when their sum is not an integer. This can be relevant to the differential analysis regarding the order of the pseudo-differential operators. And then you easily see this does not build a locality semigroup. So, okay. So first of all, let me just relate it to known concepts. This is not new, and usually it's not looked at in the commutative setup. All this was commutative. We didn't need more. We did it all in the commutative setup. And then we realized that indeed it would be useful to look at the non-commutative one. You see, it goes back to 72. And then there's a categorical generalization that we came across looking at canonical relations. And it's related to singularities, because it's related multiplication of Wolfram sets, so which carry the singularities of distributions. This is interesting to see in in relation to this more modest setup we have, because what we're doing is a kind of selective category over one object. Okay, just one object. Okay, so I told you M minus CK is not an idea. This polar part, even in the multivariate setup, which might be disappointing, but to be expected, yet it is a locality ideal. And now I can tell you what it is. It just says, as before, so remember the problem was in one variable, Z over Z gave you a fake planar. So, and we now say Z1 over Z2 does not give you a fake finite part because Z1 is distinct from Z2. So that's what we're saying here. H prime, as long as you take it to have nothing to do with H over LS, which will be polar to twin. So we're in this ideal, in this subset of polar germs. This meant that the top part has nothing to do with the bottom part. And now we're assuming this third function has nothing to do with either of them. Then, indeed, by definition, a product will still be polar. So that's what we mean by locality. So there's no problem of counterparts to deal with. Okay, once you have this category, then you have to make sure you don't leave it. So you have to build the morphisms that respect it. So it's just taking the graph of a locality relation to the graph of another. Okay, so it's very natural. And you can relate that. I already mentioned to you wavefront sets, which are, in fact, which carry this singularities of kernels, so of Fourier integral operators or pseudo-differential operators. And just for any of you who's more familiar with this language, this is to point out that locality would be pseudo-locality. You could find independence of support functions by the fact that their distance is larger than some given epsilon. And this is related to pseudo-locality, for example, Shubin find this at some stage. And it can be useful to detect kernels, which ones are pseudo-local, and if you put instead of epsilon zero, then you're back to locality. Pseudo-differential operators are different operators. So here, the kernel is epsilon local if and only if this, which the identity map, so this is smooth functions with compact support on a subset. This is this epsilon locality. And here, this is the same set of functions, but now with this K in the middle. Okay, you can think of three functions, for example. This is a locality map, says that K is epsilon local, just to relate it to other notions of locality. And then this was locality map, was just about preserving locality relations, but then you want to have locality morphisms. And it's obvious what you want, that when you can multiply, then the phi should behave as real for a morphism. It should be compatible with. Okay, so now we're all set to generalize univariate minimal subtraction to multivariate minimal subtraction without having to deal with counterterms. And this is what we're going to do. So let's go back to our two protagonists, if you remember. Main one, in fact, the only one is the projection. This is going to tell us how to throw away the polar part. And a result is that it's a locality morphism of locality algebras. That's already encoded the fact that it's useful for us because we preserve locality. And then after that, once you're there, you just evaluate and then nothing happens. It's also a locality character. So locality is preserved. So the theorem is disappointing if you start from parity morphism, so if you had these formations we had at the beginning, or you have also Feynman integrals, as long as you had you did it according to the locality principle to start with encoded in quantum field theories, will be there, you will start with a locality morphism. What could have happened is that you could pass locality while renormalizing. This procedure, thanks to the locality of this projection, tells that you will not have lost it. So you could indeed evaluate without risking having lost locality. So let me conclude. Partial multiplicativity is preserved after renormalization. One might say it's only partial. No, because that's what we wanted. We only wanted to multiply things that were independent. So it's not partial. I mean, it's the word partial, but it's what we wanted. Indeed, the renormalized do factorize on independent elements. Everything was for that. Now, it looks as though there's not much to all this, but real work, we've just shifted the real work. The work is there. It's to make sure that we do land via this phi, either on Feynman graphs or on cones or trees, that we indeed land meromorphic functions with linear poles. And that's the work is to be done. It can take a whole article to prove that. Once we know this, then we can recognize, and there's nothing to do, it's all there. We just apply pi plus, and we're done. Let's see what happens for these higher zeta functions. So, as I said, each case proving this takes a whole lot. So, for example, this one, exponential sums on rational convex cones, the orthogonality locality relation I mentioned to you, they do land in meromorphic functions with linear poles. So why not? You just think of a smooth cone, a simple one, and then you can see it, and then using visions, you can prove it for a cone. It sounds kind of obvious then, but you have to prove that everything is in the subdivisions, and that takes time. So it's a geometric construction. Orthogonality is the geometric construction. Bronstein functions, they're more set theoretic. No geometry there, a priori. We think now of putting some geometry, but a priori there's not. It's not orthogonality. This is a set theoretic locality relation. So one of the questions, it's said, just saying that two trees are independent where they're when decorated by disjoint sets of decoration. And also, it took us an article to prove that we landed in there. It was even more complicated. So we use the universal properties of trees. We use the symbol language. I didn't tell you everything. In fact, we used symbols with values in multivariate meromorphic functions. So there are the objects to deal with, but they're what we need here. So we needed symbols. I hope it's now to you that symbols were useful. And now, because we're doing it in a multivariate setup, the variables pull up, and we end up with symbols with used in multivariate functions. That's it. Kind of awkward. Anybody who's familiar, this is a generalization of holomorphic families of pseudo-differential symbols that has been said. Gauge symbols for those who are familiar with Guillemin's work. Okay, now what properties do we get? They're rational. That's maybe a bit disappointing, but that's expected. Why? Because these sums involve the Euler-Maclaurin formula to relate them to integral, and the Arc-Laurent formula involves Bernoulli numbers and these rationals. So that's where the rationality comes in. And also, we do nothing. Otherwise, we use lifting from the root to the tree. It doesn't seem is a very linear procedure, which doesn't put the rationality at risk. The convex lattice cones, it's also rational, and that is because of the compatibility of this division with linearity. Now, do they really generalize the known objects? Yes, we started relating multiple zeta functions, branch zeta functions related to ladder trees, and indeed they do restrict to ordinary multiple zeta functions, ladder trees and on-chain cones. There are Stoffel relations which correspond to compatibility with on cones. There are also Shuffle relations, but this would be another story. And then the branch sum on trees finalized through words. So you kind of flatten your tree on the ground and you make words out of this, and you can this way factorize them words and hence relate them again to multiple zeta functions. Now, in the last minute, so a work in progress. So there are a lot of things we fixed along the way. Generalized evaluator is just one of them. Those of you who are familiar with analytic regularization, Spear, can maybe figure out that it's not the kind of regularization. So looking into that right now. And then we can think of a more abstract locality relation instead of this orthogonal one for which we use for meromorphic functions. So, because remember, for trees, we had set theoretic one cones, geometric, and we want to put them in one bag. And in one bag is making sense of an abstract framework encoding both. Didn't comment too much on it, but I told you at some point we fixed an inner product, and so we want to understand what happens when we change it, and that's where renormalization group should be hidden. And behind the scene there's also a complement map which is behind the orthogonality and the theoretic locality relation, taking the orthogonal to a space, taking the complement set to a set, and we want to bring that on the abstract level. Open question is the renormalization group. We've got ideas, but it's still very long to really understand what, how to define it, and references to this. And I think my time is over, so thank you for your attention.
Are there questions on this side? Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, I could ask this question in person, but since I'm here. So, this is a very nice general scheme. So, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can see your face, but I can't see your face, but I can hear you.
Okay, that's important. So, does this work of Kai Keller, you're probably familiar with, on regularization and renormalization, in the Epstein-Glaser framework, does this fit into your general scheme of multivariate regularization?
Yeah, okay. So, yes. Does the regularization using the Epstein-Glaser formulation fit into this framework? So, Epstein-Glaser factor is in space-time. This implicitly was in momentum, setup. So you might be familiar with Bin Zhang and Get Dung, who looked at the Epstein-Glaser approach to understand Feynman graphs on manifolds. So yes, the short answer is yes, it has been done precisely, but it so much depend on the specific framework. Every time the work to show that the functions, meromorphic functions linear poles, and for that you would need to just blow up procedures as they commonly used in quantum field theory.
Okay.
Answer your question?
Yeah.
Are there any other questions over here? All right, let's turn it over to Max Planck then.
Okay. Questions here? Awesome. You play similar to with other functions. Z function.
Like which one?
My okay. Hmm? Why do you need infinite sums? Could you just finite sums?
Oh, finite sums. I wouldn't. Oh, yeah, sorry. Do I need. So there were two questions. Could we do that for other interesting number theoretic functions? And the question is, why do we need infinite sums? Why not finite? Our job is to renormalize. When there's nothing to renormalize, well, we just take the value given for us. And if it's a finite sum, I misunderstood your question. There's no divergence to expect. The problem is that you expect divergence. We maybe do it for other functions, you know, kind of branching them. I haven't thought of it. We branch a function through a tree. And you might wonder why trees, why cones? Trees, so you should keep in mind this this model by Kreimer to try to model in a very simplified way the subdivergence complexity in quantum field theory and Kreimer integrals using the a very simple, similar to this model. Instead of branching sums as we did, you branch integral. In fact, we're working on that right now in a paper. So you can also do this, and this relates strongly to quantum field theory via this Kreimer toy model. Otherwise, why trees? Because they're simple. Because they give a hierarchy and are useful to try to understand, at least from a mathematical point, what the renormalization should be. And maybe we could do it for other functions. I haven't thought of function. Ah, yeah, maybe. Okay. So for Eisenstein. So you see, the way we branch is building from the we look at an operator. Otherwise, we have difficulty branching. You know, it has to. We at least have had to interpret it as an operator. So this was a summation operator for the Kreimer model integral integration operator. Maybe yes, we could think about that. I haven't thought about that.
Sure, so